listening to the Head in the Clouds podcast, a proud member of the Converge Podcast Network. Now to the man with his head constantly in the clouds, your host, Ryan Romeo.
And now my next guest, I am so excited to have here on the podcast today, Chris Huerts, the best-selling author of The Sacred Enneagram, which for me and my church has been hugely instrumental for team growth and for personal growth, and work with a lot of college students, and they are loving The Sacred Enneagram. He's also a speaker, and his wife, Felina, is also an author and speaker. Chris, welcome to the Head in the Clouds podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Appreciate you making room to include me.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I always kind of do this whenever I have a guest. I really want to get to know you a little bit and get to know your story, because I just feel like there's so much power in hearing each other's stories. Take us back. I think a lot of people are going to be familiar with your book. A lot of people are going to be familiar with you as a speaker and author. But before any of that came along, what did your journey of faith look like in the beginning?
So these are always sort of longer stories than we realize, because I think when we look back, we sort of see how all of the paths that have led us to where we're at were always in place. Grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, the oldest of six. My parents were Catholic when I was younger, went to Catholic elementary school. I got really, really ill, had scarlet fever, viral spinal meningitis and encephalitis, and was in a coma dying.
Wow.
And a pastor at a Protestant church in town came and prayed over me. And literally, I woke up at the end of the prayer. 15 doctors and interns were in and out over the next several days trying to figure out what had happened. And I joke around that my parents were kind of like, whoa, that guy's magic's better than our priest's magic. Let's just go to his church. So moved from a Catholic parish to a sort of a soft, charismatic, sort of pre-evangelical mega church. And grew up in that space, but not really concerned, I guess. Didn't really take my faith seriously. But it was when I was in high school. I spent a summer doing some volunteer work on a Navajo reservation in New Mexico. And I think the spirituality of that community, I think the hospitality of that community, and I think the group that I was with really sort of opened things up for me in a way that allowed for there to be a kind of embrace with the divine in a space that I think would have been really charged for something like that. And of course, now as I look back on it, it's 30 some years later, it's really sort of shaped how I've aligned my vocational fidelity with what it means to sort of be in sync with God. Mm. And that, I think, took a lot of hard work, and I think that took a lot of failure, and I think that took a lot of sort of bumping around on the bottom of life. But my first job out of university, I moved to South India. I helped start the first pediatric AIDS care home in South Asia, in those eight countries. That led to a 20-year sort of humanitarian stint where we did a lot of anti-trafficking work. And I think in that, all of my notions of who saves whom were challenged. The so-called donor-receptor roles were turned upside down. And I think looking back to that reservation in New Mexico and looking to the graveyards in South India and looking to the red light areas in different parts of the world where we worked and served, I think my entire faith journey could be summed up in following my friends who are poor to God's heart and being converted together into the new we. And so it's not been an isolated experience outside of relationship or community.
Mm. Yeah, I think many of us who have had, my wife and I have done some work overseas as well, and we all kind of have that moment where you go overseas and you're like, I came here to help you, but I feel like I am gaining so much from you and your culture and everything else. And the tables always get turned. I mean, I feel like God always does that in our lives, and the table gets turned and the blessing is kind of surprising on the other side.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. You know, I was reading on your website, it said that you worked with Mother Teresa. Is that true?
Yeah, so when I lived in South India, I would frequently go up to Calcutta three or four times a year. And whenever she was in town, she was always gracious enough to spend some time with me. And if I had friends visiting or groups visiting, she'd always sit with us and reflect with us. And so I probably sat with her a dozen to 15 times. And every time I was with her, she'd give me a little note or a prayer card or a crucifix or a little medal of the Virgin Mary. And, you know, in my early 20s, I didn't really realize, I think, the scope of the impact she was having internationally. Mm-hmm. Certainly, it was making a huge impression on me. But man, the bummer is I think I've misplaced or lost almost everything she's given me.
Oh no.
Except for the things that I gave my mom. And now, like, I go over to my mom and dad's place and I'm like, that little note was for me. I want that back now. And it's like, nope.
Oh man. What was it like to sit with her? What was the biggest thing that you gained from your time with her?
I think her presence was one that was deeply marked by love. I think, you know, I say this a lot, that the things that we learn on the deepest, most impactful levels from our teachers, our guides, our mentors, isn't the things they say. It's watching them align their values and how they embody that through their life. And I think that was really the great takeaway from Mother. It was like every time you were with her, you felt as if you were the most important person in the world. You felt seen and heard. You felt loved. And you know, that's really what she was about, was trying to discover the divine in everyone she interacted with, and was always looking for that sort of grace-filled interruption of the presence of Christ and what she called the disguising distress of those who were suffering and those who were poor. And so you felt that even in having a cup of tea with her, that it was deeply spiritual. She was seeing God even in those moments. And that also changed so much for me.
That is, it's such a simple thing, but really, sadly, just such a rare thing these days to have people slow enough to consider you and be with you on that sort of level.
Yeah. Remarkable, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. You were doing a lot of work overseas. You were really starting to do a lot of justice work and things like that. What was that point for you when you started to realize yourself as a writer? Because you've written a lot of books. What was that point for you where you're like, you know what, maybe I want to actually put some of these thoughts and experiences down on paper?
Well, so my former community, like I said, I started in South Asia a few years into it, became the international director for this little organization. My wife and I helped grow that out to about 350 people working in 15 countries. Hmm. And we had this print journal that we sent out to 21,000 subscribers. And it was really a journal that would reflect quarterly on our group's sort of shared intentional spirituality. And it was remarkable, the reflections that were coming from these places of deep pain. We would have a child living on the streets share a reflection, and we would get folks like Jean Vanier or Jürgen Moltmann or these, you know, Miroslav Volf, these theologians that we were trying to actually live into and practice the things that they were putting on paper. Mm. So I took some of the best of these reflections and I compiled them into a reader and I sent that out to a number of publishers. And of course they were like, no, if it's been published before, we really can't take a look at it. And especially the multi-author thing is harder and harder to market and sell. And so there was an editor at InterVarsity Press, David Zimmerman, who was like, but hey man, if there's something that you'd like to write, I'd love to work with you. And so David gave me a shot, and that was what led to my first book, a little reflection on kind of a missional spirituality. The second book ended up being through the Center for Reconciliation at Duke's Divinity School. And I co-wrote that with an ethicist named Christine Pohl. The third book was really a painful confession of what it looks like to fail in community. And that was really at the end of the 20 years of my humanitarian work. Flynn and I took about a year to kind of reflect on the ups and downs, the good and the bad, the successes and failures. And this was about 7 years ago. We hit the hard reset and we started a new nonprofit, this little organization called Gravity, which is a center for contemplative activism. And very simply put, we're just helping people who help people by introducing meditation, mindfulness, and contemplative practices to folks with active lives. You can imagine that the Enneagram became a great support to helping folks along their contemplative journey.
Yeah.
I had been lucky enough to train and study with some of the greatest living teachers in the world, some of the legacy teachers who developed this Enneagram of personality system 50 years ago. So a few years ago, I decided to start to reflect a little bit on how to align your Enneagram type with your spiritual formation, how we nurture and nourish our spirituality based on the parts of ourself that we maybe don't want to be honest with, and the parts of ourself that we've hidden in our shadow, and the parts of ourself mm-hmm. that can actually lead us into really the gifts of our essence or our truest or most authentic self.
Yeah. And I think that's what's so powerful about it, and why I think so many churches are grasping this for their teams and for themselves too, really trying to dig down into, okay, how has God created the people on my team? How do we all interact with it? And I love the spiritual aspect of it, because I think so many of us have you could just get the kind of cold, okay, you know, this is your personality test, you know, here, this is what you're like. But with your book, you really dove into the spiritual side of it, the good and the bad. I really think that it's been so, so instrumental for our team. And I'm sure you're hearing that, you know, from all over the place.
Yeah, I think it's right on time. I have this conversation a lot about my ideas and the theories around why people think it's becoming more and more accessible and popular. And I try not to get sort of salty and grumpy about the mugs and memes culture, where I think some of it gets thinned out. But I do think, as we sort of look back in terms of how we've plugged in our sense of self digitally over these past 10 years, 15 years into the various sort of social media accounts that essentially define who we want to be perceived as, some of us are getting tired of that this yeah. projection of our ego mythology and all of this notion of a loss of true contact with our so-called friends, fans, and followers isn't enough. And it maybe has diluted many of us into this idea that we don't know who we are. And so here yeah. comes something like the Enneagram, and it says, well, actually, here's a roadmap. And this is a compassionate sketch of possibilities of who you can become once you figure out where you're at and what you've forgotten, what you've lost contact with. So yeah. I think it's a great support to this kind of correction that many of us need as we try to discern and determine these fundamental questions rooted in essence, identity, dignity, and how that plays out in our relationships.
Yeah, I think coming from a context of me working in a church, I see so many people, this comparison that comes up on social media. You see somebody that you look up to or respect or whatever, and I see so many people kind of try to fashion their lives around what they see online. And it is part of, I think, what's so countercultural about the Enneagram, even though it's becoming so ingrained in our culture currently, but this sort of counterculture of saying, hey, pay attention to the way that you're wired, pay attention to yourself, have a high value for the way that you are, and understand that, you know, when you're seeing somebody online, that is them, you know, that, and that's not you. And I think that's why this subject is just so impactful right now.
Yeah. And I think this is the challenge with it. I think this has always been the challenge with this tradition and this teaching, is that we want to understand the people in our life. We want to project outside of ourselves what we don't want to contend with inside of ourselves. We want to sort of have those ways of perceiving our most significant and intimate friendships and relationships. But the man who developed the Enneagram of Personality back in 1971, 72, and 73, this Gestalt Chilean psychoanalyst, the late Claudio Naranjo, made his early students all sign a confidentiality agreement saying that they wouldn't share this or teach this until they had done their own work. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like that is maybe a good reminder for where things have gotten in 2019, 2020 with this, that until I actually internalize, metabolize, and incorporate this for myself, it doesn't really help putting it on my partner, on my coworkers, on my community mm-hmm. members. And that's a bummer, because as soon as somebody comes across the Enneagram, as soon as they figure this out, the energies of these nine types, then the very next thing they want to do is share it with people and put type on people and
yeah.
try to understand people through the lens of this. Mm-hmm. And you can see how that leads to all sort of confusion and can actually lead to pain.
Yeah.
Is if I don't start with myself, if I don't love myself, if I don't hold myself with compassion, if I don't allow every part of myself to belong, then the truth is no part actually belongs. And in fact, I can't belong to these people that I also want to share this with.
You're listening to the Converge Podcast Network. And now, a message from a network supporter.
This podcast is sponsored by Denison Ministries. Denison Ministries is a movement creating 7 million culture-changing Christians who are committed to carrying out the truths of the gospel to their spheres of influence. They do this in a variety of ways, which is why Denison Ministries is excited about sponsoring the Head in the Clouds podcast. One of the cool ways Denison Ministries helps Christians feel closer to God is through their First 15 devotional. First 15 is designed to help you spend the first 15 minutes of your day experiencing God through meaningful devotionals, scripture readings, worship, and prayer. Grow closer to God this year. You can sign up for the First 15 email devotional sent directly to your inbox at first15.org/subscribe. Start your day off with the First 15 devotional podcast anywhere you listen. I think the Enneagram is so powerful, but I was, you know, wondering what you thought of, can we take it too far or can we take it too literal? Or is there some sort of way that we could use it? Obviously, anything can be used in an unhealthy way. But for me, I'm a three, you know, I'm achieving. I love to get things done. I love that. And so much of it, when I read the Enneagram theory, I'm like, yes, 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 that is so much like me. But there's this kind of nuanceical, you know, sometimes I don't act like that always, you know, sometimes, and I find people on my team go, oh, you're a three, that's why you're doing that. Or, oh, you're a six, that's why you're doing that. How can we use the Enneagram in a way that's maybe not always just boxing people in too much too?
Yeah. So see, that's the danger here. And I think the danger, and maybe danger is too strong of a word. I think the challenge maybe is the Enneagram of personality actually doesn't describe your quirks and foibles and caricatures. It actually shows you how you want to be loved and how you suffer not being loved in that way. And so for three, it's actually really sad that one of the names that has kind of stuck for type three is the achiever. Because for the three, it's never been about success or failure. It's always been about love. And you see the three who is in the middle of the heart center is actually one of the most disconnected from their own hearts. And so as little kids, what did they do? They wanted to fill that emptiness. They wanted something to be proven as valuable within that sort of emotional way of perceiving themselves in the world. And as a little kid, what was easy? It was chasing down recognition, affirmation, attention, rewards. And the little three, of course, then trades all of that out as a proxy, as a substitute for love. But you see, the three is still too smart for that. This three still realizes all this affirmation and attention isn't love. And as much of this as I'm trying to stuff into the emptiness of my heart, there's still a kind of loneliness there. So then what does the three do? They try to prove themselves as valuable, because you see, there's this lie in the back of their head that says, if you're valuable, then you'll be lovable. And if you're lovable, you'll get what you want. And so it's never been about success or failure. It's never been about achieving. It's always been about getting love. But as little kids, we don't have, I think, this sort of sophistication to realize or to observe our own motivations in these ways. And so we kind of get in a lane. The lane becomes a rut. The rut becomes fixated. And yes, now we over-identify with the fixation. And so when somebody says, well, oh, you're being such a three, it's actually really unhelpful, because the language that they're using actually is often lacking the compassion for, oh, it's not that you're such a three. It's that there you go again, trying to chase down love, trying to earn something that you can't earn, trying to gain something that was ascribed to you in your essence. And rather than being a three, it's, could you just say yes to yourself?
Yeah.
Because there's nine ways that we've said no, right?
Yeah.
It's a bummer.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so powerful. I mean, the way you just explained it, I was like, I don't, it feels so different as a three to hear you talk to me that way. And I feel like so many of us come from that. Like, I mean, I think we and when you said it, it's kind of like you get, the danger is you get just enough of the information to go, oh, I could summarize you in this one quick number. But still, I mean, if there's a condescension on the background, if there's a, you know, trying to figure you out on the background, in the background of their comments, everybody feels that, you know, just a little bit.
Yeah. And so that's where, you know, we can rewind a little bit and we can say there are ways to describe the essence and the energy and the structure of somebody who's dominant in type three without it being a prison. There's ways to bring compassion into this and say, yeah, this is probably typical of how you try to de-escalate conflict. This is probably typical in terms of how you try to get love. This is probably typical in terms of how you perceive yourself in the world. And what happens here is we can either stay imprisoned in this. We can either allow type structure to contain and hide our essence from us, or we can actually, like one of my teachers says, work to turn these prison walls translucent so that our essence can radiate through it. And either way you approach it, it will be effective. Either way you approach it, it will feel to a certain degree accurate. Either way you approach it, there's still something of awareness that can be helpful in this. But man, it's like, you know this, if we can't self-observe, we can't self-correct. And the ways that we self-observe will either lead to kind of a punitive shaming that's regret and fear-based, or it can really be rooted in love and compassion and grace and really lead to freedom.
Now, for you personally, number one, I'm just curious, what number are you?
So I'm dominant in Enneagram type 8. That's always funny because when I introduce 8 energy at workshops or talk about 8s or let folks know that I'm an 8, inevitably what somebody will say is, oh yeah, I used to work with a really unhealthy 8. And then I kind of respond, well, they were probably just an 8 and you probably weren't standing up for yourself. So all of us are tragically misunderstood.
Yeah.
And all of us project that misunderstanding.
Yeah. You know, I was actually talking with a friend of mine recently, and we were talking a little bit about personality, and he was sharing with me, like, just in life, he said, I'm feeling a little bit lonely, feeling kind of separated from everybody. And he said, I just feel like nobody gets me. I feel like nobody really understands me. And it's funny, and it's just kind of a moment of clarity for me, as, you know, classically, I'm not so introspective on how I feel, but I came out and just said, well, kind of joined the club. I feel a little separated from people too. And I said, you know, for me, sometimes that's actually kind of this beautiful marker of there's areas in your life and in your heart that really nobody will fully understand except outside of the context of God, you know. So God gets this view of you that nobody gets to. And I don't know if this is something that you concur with, but I feel like all of us deep down have a little bit of that loneliness and that feeling of I'm not fully known and I don't even know how to articulate what's going on inside of me. Is that something, as you're working with people, and is that something that you've ever experienced too?
Yeah. So I think that's a very common experience to all of humanity. That actually sort of points back to, I think, our need for contemplative practice, right? We try to frame contemplative practice through interior postures of solitude, silence, and stillness. And of course, this is something that I learned from watching in even Mother Teresa. And in one of the busiest, and at that time when I lived in India, one of the poorest cities in the world, yes, solitude, silence, and stillness sure seemed like a luxury for someone like her, but she had a commitment to creating these as interior postures so that she didn't burn out, so that her spirituality, even in the face of the doubts she suffered, thrived. Now, my sense is, in particular, solitude is how we confront that sort of existential loneliness of being human. Because if we can't go inward, if we can't actually practice saying yes to ourselves, then we're never going to learn to be present to ourselves. And if we can't be present to ourselves, then we certainly can't be present even in our most meaningful and deep relationships. And so there is surprisingly a kind of loneliness that people find in those. And of course, if we can't be present to ourselves, we can't be present to divine love. And so, in a sense, we're doing this to ourselves. In a sense, our inability to say yes to me, to hold myself with compassion, to accept all of myself, is what prevents me from belonging, from feeling known, from being seen, from being held and loved. So this is why I think contemplative practice is not only a correction to what's out of control in our lives, but it's fundamental to living and living free.
Yeah. And I think that is really so key right now. I mean, there's so many people out there that are dealing with anxiety and this sort of interior, this loss of interior control, this like this sense of, even when things are going okay in life, we're just plagued with this sense of anxiety. And we were talking about it recently that, you know, 40% of Americans were saying they're more anxious about the future this year than they were last year. And you could look at the outward thing and go, okay, well, maybe there's some outward stresses in their life. But so much of this is this sort of interior world that gets out of control. And I love what you were saying, just that discipline of being quiet. What are some things for you? Because you live in America, you live in the place where it's very noisy. What are some disciplines for you to help you quiet down enough?
So I live a very active life. I routinely am on 110 to 130 flights a year. We have a very full sort of community life here, and our friends are great and actually allow for the kind of work that is so demanding. But if I actually don't practice a kind of interior stillness, then I really find myself becoming sort of unhinged, uncentered. So for me, stillness practices include guided meditations. I've found that a loving kindness practice, which is a kind of non-judging, inclusive practice for myself that also leads to a kind of inclusion for others, has been really helpful. When I'm able, I also found that the Ignatian examen, this kind of using memory to sort of discover God in the ordinary, has also been really helpful. But again, you find whatever these, let's say, exercises for your spirituality are, and just like any kind of exercise, these things will stagnate. These things will sort of only take you so far. And this is why we need, let's say, cross training for muscle confusion. And so there are a dozen to 15 practices that kind of make up the rhythms for the work that we do. And those are the practices that we then share and facilitate in our retreats and in our workshops.
That's awesome. Now, for people that are listening that might be church leaders or people that are leading teams, what are some healthy ways that they can use the Enneagram, and maybe not in the kind of judgmental way like we were talking about earlier, but in a way that really enables them to lead better for their teams?
Well, I think maybe the best way to use this is to work on yourself, is to look inward and realize that, you know, the Enneagram will describe the nine basic fears and the nine basic desires that are sort of common to humanity. And if you kind of look at the landscape of religious expression, it sure seems that a lot of Eastern religions have this kind of focus on the sort of mitigating of desire, because desire is often the source of our pain or suffering. And then you kind of look at some of the Western religions, and they really are heavily fear-based. And I think in the Enneagram, you kind of find yourself stuck between that. You kind of find yourself stuck between being afraid of your desires, or being afraid of getting what you want, or being afraid of having these actual aspects of yourself unhindered, unleashed, freed out. So I think if you can start with yourself by kind of confronting some of these fears and kind of receiving the gifts of some of these desires, but then looking beyond those to see, what lies are they fortifying? What prison cells are they keeping us sort of spiritually incarcerated in? Then yes, that's the first step. And like I said, I think the first step is always starting with ourself. It's realizing that I only can take somebody as far as I've gone myself in any sort of team, in any sort of relationship, in any sort of mentoring sort of exchange. And so it's not for the sake of trying to lead others with this that we go inward with it. It's really to free ourselves. But that's the invitation. And that's, I think, what's really hard for some people right now, because like I said, you learn this, you see it everywhere, and then you become kind of any evangelist putting type on everyone in your life.
Yeah. And which we've all had. Yeah, we've all had the people. And a few of them in my life, I really love where they're coming from, and it is this kind of desire to get to know each other. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about your book and about the Enneagram, just encouraging us to at least get our head above water a little bit with each other and go, oh, you know, maybe this is kind of the way that you're wired. And before you start taking offense to people, start really trying to dive into, okay, what are some maybe deeper motivations? And I think the positive side has really created an environment, at least for where we are on our team, an environment of being curious about each other and going, oh, are you experiencing this? Is this what you're going through? And I think that that's been something that's been invaluable from the Enneagram.
It does connect us to our shared human experience. It does help us realize that, like I don't want to overplay this languaging, but it really does help us realize that we belong. And that's where it, like I said, it comes back as a tremendous support to our contemplative practice. It comes back to really support our becoming with this kind of compassionate self-acceptance. Now, I also will say this, just because you do the hard soul work and your inner work, and for those of us who will bring the Enneagram as a teaching or tool or support for that, I have to say it's still not going to change everything.
Yeah.
And that's because nothing changes everything, right? This is why exactly. So many of us are part of congregations of people who've been converted but are still racist and still don't recycle. Mm-hmm. Even conversion doesn't change everything. Yeah. And so you also have to realize this is simply a tool. This is simply one way of supporting that sort of belonging that leads and supports our becoming.
I love that. I love that. Chris, thank you so much for taking time to be on the podcast today. Where could people learn a little bit more about your book and about you as a speaker?
So you can check out our little nonprofit at gravitycenter.com. I will do probably, hopefully, less than 40 Enneagram workshops in 2020, but you can already see the ones that are open for registration at sacredenneagram.org. Always glad to include folks in those and try to make it as practical and helpful and really sort of empowering as possible.
That's awesome. Chris, thank you so much for being on the Head in the Clouds podcast. It's been a real pleasure.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Listening to Head in the Clouds with Ryan Romeo. For more information about this show, visit convergepodcastnetwork.com. This show is part of the Converge Podcast Network.